I am mannequin, mannequin designer. La 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 la. I can make anything, anything you desire. La 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 la. Something like that.
This is Little America, a show about the immigrant experience, one story at a time. I am your host, Kumail Nanjiani. I think we've all had moments when something goes horribly wrong, or we're hit with a strange coincidence or a hilarious misunderstanding and thought, maybe my life would make for some incredible content. Maybe an autobiography, maybe a film or a painting, or maybe, just maybe, a musical. Davy Rothbart has the story.
Hurry, this bell will only last 5 minutes.
James Chow's musical, Mannequin Man by Day, Tenor by Night, is hurtling toward its climax. A stream of life-size suitcases and duffel bags waddle on stage, brought to life by the actors ensconced in them. Then, the luggage begins to sing. A Samsonite chorus.
I be wanting Mr. Johnson traveling to Boston. Hey, 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 hey.
I be wanting Mrs. Johnson traveling to Houston. Hey,
hey. It's 2017, and James Chow is a music student at Cal Arts outside Los Angeles. But he's different from his classmates. For one thing, he's 68 years old. His play is zany and heartfelt. The main character, also named James, survives one of modern China's most chaotic periods. He comes to America, starts a family, and starts a business too, making and selling mannequins. But what he really wants, the thing that drives the central tension of the musical, is to become an opera singer. All of this, it's from James's real life. The real James Chow built a business making and selling mannequins. But for most of his life, what he really wanted was to become an opera singer. This real story that parallels the story of the musical is the story we're going to tell today. It's the story of a man grappling with two sides of himself, the successful entrepreneur and the lifelong artist, and his efforts to build a bridge between them.
I thought I did a pretty good job, you know, so I was so excited.
On the night of the premiere of Tenor by Night, at a concert hall on the campus of Cal Arts, James was on the cusp of realizing the dream he'd been working toward for years, maybe his whole life.
But there's a little problem with one of the singers.
He's referring to one of his student actors, meant to play the linchpin role of the magician.
He was a very good singer, but he was nervous. So someone told him right before the concert, if you're nervous, take some of the brownie or something.
Like a marijuana brownie?
Yeah, brownie.
Somebody tried to relax the guy playing the magician by giving him, like, dosing him with THC, like a marijuana brownie before the show. Uh-oh.
Right.
And
he just totally lost. So he couldn't sing.
Picture the dressing room of the Roy O. Disney Concert Hall. A young man sprawled out on the floor, his eyes bleary, pointed in separate directions. Unable to put a sentence together, much less sing and dance before a sold-out crowd. James had untangled a lot of complicated situations in his life, but this was a new one. And the curtain was set to rise in 10 minutes. Rewind back a few years to his audition at CalArts, and you'd catch a prime example of James problem-solving on the fly. Applying to CalArts, it's not like at an ordinary college. You don't just zip them your SAT scores and an essay about volunteering at a soup kitchen. The Vocal Performance MFA program requires an audition before a panel of judges, which is why James found himself standing in front of three dour-faced professors who solemnly took notes as James sang for them.
They told me to sing two songs, so I sang Italian aria and then a Chinese folk song. They said, okay, do you have anything else to show us?
He'd only prepared two songs for his audition, but had a moment of inspiration. As he burst into his third song, another Italian aria, he began simultaneously to move his body through a series of traditional Chinese martial arts poses known as Tai Chi.
So they said, wow, never saw that, you know, Tai Chi with the opera, you know. So they said, oh, this guy, this old guy must have something.
James's wife, Lily, had also been watching the audition. Neither she nor James could tell whether the Tai Chi gambit had really worked. So Lily decided to try one more thing.
My wife would bring up all the mannequin catalogs, you know, and show them, yeah.
Mannequin catalogs. Because James, at 65, had a successful business designing and manufacturing mannequins.
Yeah, this is what our business is. It's selling mannequins. They said, oh, this is nice. That's nice, you know.
Suddenly, James felt the judges showing a new curiosity about him as a prospective student. It would be another month before he'd find out the final verdict. But on a call with the head of the MFA program, where she remembered him as the mannequin man, he got the news he'd been waiting for. He was in. How did you feel when you found out you were really going to be admitted as a student?
Well, it's like a dream come true, you know, because my father, my brother, you know, they all went to music schools. And I'm the only one that didn't do it, you know. So, like, after all, now life take me back to the same path, you know. So I feel better late than never.
James grew up in a family of musicians. His mom was an accomplished singer, and his dad was a celebrated composer. But music wasn't the life he had planned for himself.
I was studying in high school, and I was on my way to study in the best college in China. So I was more thinking more about science, mathematics, and that kind of career.
But as James was graduating high school in the late 1960s, a major shift in China had just taken root.
You know, during the Cultural Revolution, you know, all the intellectuals were criticized. They were sent to, you know, so-called schools.
The Cultural Revolution was a dark 10-year campaign of chaos and violence, where vast numbers were persecuted, with more than a million deaths. Academics, intellectuals, writers, and artists were often the targets, all considered part of the bourgeoisie. Musicians, too, including James's parents, who were sent away to what was known as a re-education school. Since his parents were musicians, James was also sent away. He'd grown up in a cosmopolitan city, surrounded by dancers, theater performers, and other artists. But during the Cultural Revolution, he was separated from the rest of his family and shipped to a remote island in the Pearl River Delta with no electricity and no running water to work long hours in the rice fields.
You don't have choice. They just tell you this is the place you are going to go. And we didn't know how long we're going to stay there. We were feeling totally lost and also scared. It's all totally different life. We were burning gasoline lamp or candles at night. Very primitive.
James would eventually channel his time on the island into a song in his musical, Tenor by Night, a song called Rice is Life.
Rice. Every year we plant rice, and every year we harvest rice.
Every grain of rice is a story, the song goes, a story of sacrifice. James wrote from his own hard-earned experience. Working 12-hour days, starting at 4 or 5 in the morning, was tedious, back-breaking.
Your feet would be standing on the field, which is covered with water. Low water, okay? No shoes. And then you bend your body to put the rice into the mud. And one by one, one by one, one by one. And the fields, it's like an endless field. You know, it's like there's no hope.
Working barefoot in low-lying water for 12 hours a day, he contracted parasitic worms that found their way into his blood and grew so sick he nearly died. Later, fungal infections led to a series of harrowing operations, but each time he was sent back to the fields. Sometimes a small moment of grace sustained him. The wordless camaraderie of his fellow outcasts, following a bird's gentle glide to the horizon. Some nights in the wee hours, he'd watch foreign cargo ships lumber past en route to Hong Kong, so tantalizingly close to shore, he could see the seamen staring back through portholes lit with blazing lanterns. And he'd catch a taste of life abroad through snatches of Radio Moscow and Voice of America that drifted in on the airwaves when the breezes blew just right. What also sustained him was music. A few years after arriving on the island, James saved up an entire year of wages and bought an accordion. He found a new place to live where he could be alone and play his instrument through the night, inside a rice warehouse, where a ladder led to a high, tiny ledge just big enough to sleep on. That tiny ledge is where James lived for years.
So I would play there, and it's good. But guess what? At night, I have company. The rats.
That was your audience?
The rats. You know, you can hear the rats moving around, you know.
What does that sound like?
They're moving around because it's a rice warehouse. Rats like rice, you know. But I get used to it.
Alone at night in the warehouse, as James's audience of rats skittered about below, he had a recurring fantasy. A miles-long steel bridge that would connect the island to the mainland, offering escape. But he knew it was an impossible dream. A bridge that long would be one of the longest bridges in the world. Tears in his eyes, he'd pick up his accordion and begin to play. After James spent 6 years on that island in the Pearl River Delta, the Cultural Revolution ended. He was reunited with his family and went to college, but dreamed of a new life in America. In 1980, James landed in Los Angeles, knowing almost nobody. It was his first time in the United States. He was 30 years old, feeling lonely, lost, and out of place in a sometimes thrilling but often harsh and confusing new land. An uncle found him work in a restaurant as a busboy. Before his first shift, his uncle gazed at him for a beat and then tossed out an American name. Jimmy, he said. Yeah, you'll go by Jimmy now. Over time, James got a job in a downtown office building and started saving money. He felt sure he could prosper in business if he could find the right product to hawk. But his attempts to sell lampshades, wooden music stands, and easels, none of them got off the ground. Then one day, easing off the freeway close to downtown, he saw a collection of striking forms gathered in a dusty storefront. Mannequins.
So I thought, oh, they look, it's kind of eye-catching, you know, with different poses, and some of them without clothing, you know. And then I thought, okay, maybe mannequins.
Their shape brought back memories of his childhood.
I live in the compound of the song and dance troupe where my parents worked. I was raised up over there. And I saw dancers rehearsing all the time. So when I saw these mannequins, that reminds me, you know, they are dancing already.
So James got into mannequins, designing, manufacturing, and distributing them. A couple years in, with his business limping along, James had an idea. He rented a booth at a massive trade show in Dusseldorf, Germany, and then began to mount what would become his first theatrical production. It was a 10-minute show, using songs from well-known operas reconfigured to fit a new plot. A Roman emperor has enlisted his top general to find the world's greatest clothes hanger. If he fails, he'll be executed. James picked up some costumes at a professional shop in Hollywood, rented a backdrop, and fabricated a 20-foot-wide clothes hanger. He shipped it all ahead to Dusseldorf. Then, to help him perform the show, he found a ringer, enlisting his brother Ping, a professional singer, to play the emperor. James played the general.
The first song is the Aida. You know, the introduction of that.
And the crazy thing is, the show, it worked. James says he still sells to customers he met that weekend more than 20 years ago. Soon, he says, contracts followed with massive chains like Macy's and JCPenney. But even as his enterprise boomed, his mind, heart, and soul began to wander from the daily trials of running a business and back to the stage, to theater, and music. James had a dream to write songs of his own, to compose an epic musical, one that evoked the story of his life. And he had an idea for how to do it. As James cruised up the freeway to CalArts for his first day of class, he felt a knot in his stomach, wondering how he'd be received.
I have two things that I thought would be kind of embarrassing to me. One is my Chinese accent. So once I talk, people automatically will notice something, you know, different or strange, you know. They will look back at me, you know. And the other embarrassing moment would be when they turn around, they see, oh, it's an old guy there. While he's here, you know, what he wants, you know.
His fellow students had green and pink hair, facial piercings, their clothes tattered with artisanal care.
I decided, okay, now I need to look young, you know, so I bought some colorful clothing, you know.
You had like hoodies and skater garb?
Yeah, then I was dressed in red and green, you know, so at least seems like, you know, not like the old-fashioned guy, you know.
But a new wardrobe wasn't enough.
So I decided, okay, I'm going to wear a wig.
A wig?
The wig is kind of a long, you know, the old style, but it's still, it make me look 30 years younger.
Like a shaggy mullet type of thing.
Yeah, it looks good on me and make me much younger.
Now James looked the part, so it was time to get to work. Quickly, James began digging in on his musical, Tenor by Night. He conceived it as a largely autobiographical story with some fantastical elements, a way to share his own zigzagging personal journey. The title, Tenor by Night, was born from an experience James had on a trip to Yosemite National Park with his wife and kids many years before.
You sing the nature, you feel very inspired, you know, and you want to sing a song. So I climb up to a big rock and I sing loudly. And then I heard someone, a voice saying, keep your day job, you know.
Keep your day job.
Yeah, I wasn't familiar with that phrase.
And he thought it might even be a compliment. Like, these strangers loved his singing. He was making new fans. His kids set him straight.
So I was kind of depressed, you know. But later, I thought, okay, yeah, I keep my day job, okay? I'll do that. But I'm a tenor by night. So that's how this name was born.
Keep your day job, they advise me.
There's a beautiful part of the musical. This is one of my favorite parts. And it's so universal because then you have someone come up and say, I'm a fireman.
Yeah.
It's my day job, but I love to paint.
I'm a security guard by day, but a writer by night.
These clips are from a performance of Tenor by Night that happened farther down the road after James's show at CalArts.
My life without dreams is so empty.
How common do you think that is for people to have these day jobs where they clock in and clock out, yeah, but then to have this sort of secret passion for art?
Yeah. I was very inspired by some other people. There are the firemen, there are the priests, even the nurses, doctors, and whatever it is. They do their job, day job, but then after the day job, they devoted themselves and to their passion.
In its Charlie Kaufman, M.C. Escher, snake eating its own tail kind of way, James's Tenor by Night play at CalArts would end up being about a guy with a day job trying to pursue his pie-in-the-sky creative dreams, written and performed by a guy with a day job trying to pursue his own nearly unreachable dreams. As James finished his first year at CalArts and moved into his second, he continued to piece Tenor by Night together. His musical tells the story of a mannequin merchant named James who dreams of becoming an opera star, though his constant singing around the house grates on his wife and kids. Exiled by his family to sing in his mannequin warehouse, everything changes when the mannequins come to life.
I think we all know that James is his own person.
This is James's wife, Lily. This individuality she's talking about, it sometimes manifests in what Lily calls restlessness, a need to always stay in motion.
He has a dream to chase, and he is chasing his dream all the time. And of course, the family sometimes do feel that they may not be as important as his music.
But for his musical, James needed Lily's help. And just as she'd helped him get into CalArts, she was ready to pitch in again. Late at night, he'd ask her for notes on his songs, often performing in their room before bed. She'd tweak his lyrics, suggestions that James welcomed since he felt her English was better than his. But writing and composing the musical was only step one. Step two, casting all the parts. He wallpapered campus with flyers, looking for student dancers, actors, and singers.
My flyer is saying like, this old guy is trying to do a concert, you know, can you come and help?
One by one, he assembled a talented, if youthful, ensemble. Again, he pulled in some ringers, a dozen professional musicians who formed a soaring orchestra. Next up, an audience. For the Tenor by Night grand premiere, James knew he wanted a full house. He made some more flyers and blitzed campus again.
I put a flyer over there to attract people to come see me, see my performance. In my flyer, I dress up like Uncle Sam. I want you, you know. So I change it to my face and say, I want you. Come to see.
Now it was time for the big performance. The final cap on his 2 years at CalArts and a lifetime of dreaming in music and stories. But there was a problem. An enormous problem. As the play began, James discovered that one of his lead actors had been completely demolished by a pot brownie. Most of Tenor by Night is autobiographical, with little dramatic, fictionalized flourishes. James's largest literary conceit was a character called the Magician, a Faustian, if gentlemanly, villain who stokes conflict, offering James and his wife Lily what they most want, but at a terribly steep price. In the play, the magician brings the mannequins in James's factory to life, and even at one point turns Lily into a mannequin. But pot brownies, they work, sometimes way too well. And the student actor meant to play the magician was writhing around backstage, his eyes spinning like merry-go-rounds.
Very talented, had a beautiful voice. I remember, wow, he couldn't sing. What are we going to do? You know, it's the next thing is coming up. He still can't. He's sitting there, is just shaking.
Lily didn't just help out tweaking lyrics. She was key to the production itself. She was the narrator. She came on stage between musical numbers to weave stories that acted as a kind of connective tissue. James and Lily's kids had gotten involved too. Their daughter Amy created the backdrop projections. And their son Brian was the stage manager. They'd built this show together. And now, on the big night, they were all there when the chips were down, and one of their lead actors was puddled on the floor. Here's Brian.
I remember being very nervous when I found out about that. And, you know, we were backstage and we see the state of the actors in, and the other actors are trying to figure out, oh my God, what do we do?
As the magician's first big scene approached, James and his family huddled backstage during a set change. Quickly, they cobbled together a plan.
When I work with my dad, I get more stressed than him, but when he's in charge, like, he knows how to always make productions come together.
So we decided, okay, all right, let's just go on with the music, because I had to be announcing who is going to sing. Well, I've got to find an excuse.
You said, well, the magician is going to sing a song, but magically, the magician disappeared.
Instead, Lily and James narrated the scene that would have taken place, while Brian devised a lengthy, mystical trombone solo in place of the song the magician was meant to have sung.
It actually had a very, very special and very good effect on this music.
Brian had leapt into action, snatching music sheets out of the hands of an actor before racing into the orchestra pit, holding the pages for the musicians and turning them one by one.
I think the piece, you know, is very magical at the end. I think everyone loved it. The show must go on.
You know, my dad really does have a cool head when it comes to these kind of just spontaneous things, because I remember him telling me when, you know, he was younger and, you know, he was in the countryside and he had to go through, you know, all those experiences, you know, a new location, not sure what the future was going to be. And I think he sort of felt like, well, I've been through this really tough hardship. Everything else after that, you know, I can deal with. And I think that cool head has really helped show that how he can persevere through anything with that kind of mindset.
In moments throughout the show, James had caught himself standing in the wings, a lump in his throat.
There was a scene about the countryside, you know, was on the island, and then the peasants were, you know, dancing, you know, they sing Rice is Life, you know. So it just brought me back to my memory 50 years ago. I thought to myself, this was real. This was real, you know. And now it's almost I was seeing the people in the island were dancing on stage, you know. But all of a sudden I realized this is America. I brought all the story, you know, on stage in America, you know, in a musical show. I was so, you know, it's based on real stories.
James had dreamed of conjuring original songs, crafting an epic musical that wove the tapestry of his life into one glittering work of art. And now he'd realized his dream.
I just feel that finally I did it. This is my own show. So I feel very, very excited when you can deliver something you promise, you know.
And then after years, maybe a lifetime of buildup, the show was suddenly over. The audience cheered wildly as the performers came on stage and gave their final bows. James took a minute to thank the crowd and express his immense gratitude for everyone who had helped him bring his show to life, his fellow students, the CalArts faculty, and of course, most of all, his family. Finally, the theater began to empty out.
And everyone was then, you know, packing up, ready to go. And I know James, he didn't want the show to end. Yeah, I think he didn't want it to end.
James was still inside the Disney Music Hall, standing at the edge of the stage in the near dark, looking out across the rows of empty seats as though scanning the horizon for passing ships.
And I guess he wanted to really cherish this moment and this achievement that he had in such a short time, being able to compose so many wonderful songs and put the big show together and be able to express himself artistically.
The musical went viral on campus.
The whole system was jammed because my video is watched by so many people.
James, the guy who was nervous about his accent and the way he dressed, who rocked a wig to look younger. His classmates loved the work that was shaped by his life story. They loved him. Every year at CalArts ends with a giant graduation ceremony. Picture the central courtyard on campus. Lush green grass, pink buds blooming in the trees.
James Chow!
A mannequin slowly edges onto the stage. The crowd goes wild.
When people see the mannequin walking on stage, they're already cheering, everybody cheering, right? All of a sudden, I turn around, it's James, right?
James is wearing a hollowed-out mannequin. As the crowd cheers, Lily runs on stage with a bouquet of red and yellow roses. She kisses James on the cheek, then spins him around and kisses the mannequin.
I think the crowd roared. Yeah, they were really surprised. This thing's never happened in the past before, I think.
For James, Lily's tiny improvised gesture held deeper meaning. It showed him that she loved all of him. The businessman who'd raised a family with her, and the artist who'd always lingered underneath.
Actually, now I think about it, it's like a very deep meaning. So since like I'm the mannequin man, so my wife is telling people, I love you, the two sides of you. I love as a tenor. But I also like you as a mannequin man. Yeah, I cannot do without her. Without my wife's support, it's impossible, you know. So, yeah. That's why I say she loves the two sides of me. The James by day and the James by night. And actually, she is now laughing at me, so... he used to call himself tenor by night, but now he's the tenor by night and day.
In the 6 years James spent working in the rice fields, could he have imagined his life in America? A thriving business, a spacious home outside LA, a wife, a family? Not really, James says. These dreams were so ethereal, so remote, so improbable, they could scarcely be imagined. But the one dream that James fixed on every night, as he played his accordion softly on his narrow ledge high above the rice warehouse, while rats pattered and screeched below, was the dream of a steel bridge that would connect his island to the mainland and carry him to new lands, new people, new adventures, new dreams. A bridge that was a complete impossibility at the time, but decades later has just recently been built. It's called the Nansha Bridge, and it's one of the longest suspension bridges in the world.
Wow, I've come a long way. And not physically such a long distance from China to here, but in life, I have come through so many different stages of life. Now, right now, it's beautiful.
Little America is an Apple TV Plus podcast produced in conjunction with the Vox Media Podcast Network. This story was reported by Davey Rothbart and Mitra Kaboli. Our editor is Jolie Myers. Our engineer is Adrian Lilly. Brandon McFarlane composed the show's theme song. Emma Gross is our senior producer. Zach Mack is our showrunner. Nishat Kurwa and Josh Behrman are the executive producers. Listen and follow on Apple Podcasts and watch Little America on Apple TV Plus where available. Season 2 of Little America premieres on Apple TV Plus on December 9th.